From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells.
Well, various COVID vaccines are being now administered and approved around the world. In Britain this week, people began receiving the Pfizer BioNTech vaccine. Both Canada and Bahrain have now approved it. Canada hopes to begin administering it next week. In Russia, there's a vaccine. It's called the Sputnik V. That's been approved. And in China, well, we're going to need help to know what's going on there. It seems as though an unapproved vaccine has been being administered. Well, joining us now to talk about the vaccine being on the docket here for approval by the FDA today and giving us an overview of COVID, and we've spoken to her just about every month since March, Tanya Lewis, the associate editor of Health and Medicine at Scientific American. Tanya, thanks for coming back and joining us on Cool Science Radio.
It's always great to be with you guys.
Well, you have been busy, no doubt, trying to keep track of approvals and the beginning of stockpiling the vaccine around the world. And tell us what you expect for today with the FDA discussion about approving one vaccine or the other. And I'm sort of assuming it's the Pfizer vaccine, but tell us about that.
Yes, so you're correct. It is the Pfizer vaccine that is being discussed today. And it's, basically this advisory group to the FDA is meeting to basically review the data that Pfizer has submitted from its clinical trial, and they will be discussing issues of efficacy and safety and deciding at the end of the day. They'll be taking a vote to decide whether or not to approve an emergency authorization for the vaccine. And if they do approve it, then it would, well, if the FDA takes their recommendation to approve the vaccine, it could be, we could expect it to be shipped out and started, vaccination could be started this weekend if it goes through. So it's very exciting, but it's all part of that process of making sure that, regulators are doing their due diligence to make sure that this is actually a safe vaccine and it's an effective vaccine. So it's a very important part of the process.
Other countries like Britain and Canada have approved it ahead of, but just by days, really, ahead of the U.S. And there is a thought that it's because they are trying to, get their hands on more doses, thinking that there may be some sort of shortage, or why? What is the strategy there? We know that logistics is huge with this vaccine.
Right. So the UK has a different regulatory process for approving vaccines than the US. The US is somewhat unique in the sense that it actually, the FDA looks at the raw data from these trials and they make their own, do their own analyses of the data. Other countries like the UK tend to sort of rely more on the companies themselves and the analysis that they do. So that's part of the reason for the difference. The FDA is moving as quickly as they can, but the process is a little more rigorous, I think, in terms of, going back and reviewing the data itself. But in terms of your question about, whether or not this will affect how much vaccine is available, I think, the U.S. government has had agreements with Pfizer and a number of other vaccine makers for months. And they sort of order a certain amount of vaccine. So I don't think it should affect, if it gets approved a week later than the UK, I don't think it's going to affect how many doses Pfizer will be able to deliver. But it's obviously a pressing question, how quickly Pfizer will be able to ramp up the number of doses that are available, because there is just such a huge demand for it now. So we'll have to see what happens in the coming months and see how many people will be able to get the vaccine.
Tanya, good morning. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. And, One of the big questions that everybody has is how long will antibodies, once the vaccination is given, will last in somebody's body? And we're just not going to know that until we start vaccinating people and doing all of these studies. Until then, we want to, mathematically, we would like to get as many people vaccinated as possible because we don't know how long the immunities will last. And the two major things that are kind of in the way of that is that there is a percentage of the population that, you know, doesn't really believe that COVID is real. And I'll just put that off to the side for now. But the other thing is people are concerned about this new technology, mRNA. We historically have given pieces of the disease to people so that their bodies can build the immunity. And mRNA is completely different, and some people are saying that it may change your actual DNA. What are your thoughts on that?
So I guess just first of all, talking about the issue of how long immunity lasts, that's absolutely true that is an open question. There is some fairly good evidence from studies of people who've had coronavirus that they have antibodies for months or longer. So there's some fairly promising evidence that if you get vaccinated, it will give you at least some protection. But you're right that we won't know exactly how long that protection will last until we've had, you know, enough time go by to really see in the full population how that looks. But to answer your question about mRNA vaccines, you're right. It is a completely new type of vaccine that hasn't really been used before, although it's been developed for years now. And I think people should not be concerned about it changing your DNA. It doesn't work like that. mRNA is basically just a little message that tells your cells to produce a piece of the virus called the spike protein. And this is just in order to prime your immune system to sort of make antibodies and make an immune response to the virus when it sees the virus. So they shouldn't be concerned that it's affecting your DNA in any way. That's, it's a new technology, but it's not fundamentally changing the, you know, way that your body responds to the virus. It's just a new way of priming the immune system.
Yeah, it's actually pretty interesting the way it's administered, and it goes into the muscular part of the shoulder. The cells use them to make the protein piece, and then once the protein piece is made, the cell breaks it down and gets its instructions, and away we go, right? That's how it works?
Yeah, that's basically the idea. So, and I think it's pretty amazing to think that in less than a year, we've been able to develop a vaccine that is as effective as the early data suggests. So, it's looking good. I mean, I can't promise anything in terms of what the FDA will decide, but it's looking very promising in terms of, vaccine efficacy greater than, on the order of 95%. So.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Tanya Lewis, Associate Editor of Health and Medicine at Scientific American. She has been publishing furiously on COVID since March, and she's joined us a handful of times to talk about it. You know, Tanya, there have been huge concerns about vaccines in general, and it's not just now. However, I would say that with all of the conspiracy theories and the things going around in social media, there is a lot more widespread just information, disinformation, misinformation, whatever you want to call it, about this particular vaccine. And there is cause for concern around vaccines, but as we know, research and science long ago debunked the question of whether the MMR, is it the MMR vaccine causing autism? It's been proven many times over and over and over again. And yet people, and oftentimes very well-educated people, hold on to this belief that vaccines are bad. Can you address that a little bit and how much of an influence you believe those beliefs will have over the distribution and the overall success of this vaccine program?
Sure. So, Lynn, I think you made a really important distinction there between sort of the long, you know, existing skepticism toward vaccines that may be grounded in conspiracy theories around things like the MMR vaccine. That sort of skepticism has no basis in the evidence. There's you know, been numerous studies sort of debunking those kinds of claims. But you do make an important point that there is legitimate reason among, you know, some groups of people to be, you know, maybe hesitant about whether to take a completely new vaccine, especially among, you know, people of color who have historically been mistreated by the medical establishment. There is a history of, you know, exploitation of, you know, people, black people and other brown Americans as well, in terms of how they are treated by the medical authorities. So I think there is some legitimacy there. What we want to make sure we do in rolling out any vaccine is that we reach out to communities and community leaders to sort of establish that trust, because you can't just expect people to automatically take a vaccine if you don't explain why it's safe and why they could benefit from it. So I think that's really important. A really important part of the process is just acknowledging people's concerns and then explaining why they could benefit greatly and why they could benefit society by helping us end this deadly pandemic.
And in order to achieve herd immunity, what are we going to need? What are the numbers in that we're going to need across a population with vaccinated people?
So I believe experts generally say we need about 70% of the population to have immunity to the virus, and that could be through either infection or through hopefully through vaccination. And with if we say that the vaccine is, you know, 95% effective, you know, without doing the exact math, you know, that's going to be slightly more than 70% of the population having been vaccinated or having the disease. So we're hoping that at least that many people will get vaccinated. Until we get to that point, you know, we might see some slowing of the spread, but it's not going to ultimately stop until at least that percentage of the population has been made immune to the virus.
And back to what you were saying about immunity and about how people have been able to hold on to it for, you know, several months. My daughter was really sick in March for about 3 weeks, but she wasn't able to get tested. She was living in Brooklyn, and every time she went to this test site after she was feeling better, she just wasn't able to get the test. They had run out of the immunity test. But for the Thanksgiving holidays, we all wanted to get tested before we got together. It was my son, my daughter, and myself. And so she had the immunity test, and she still has the antibodies, which is great. So it's been since March. So that does tell us something, doesn't it?
Yeah. So, I mean, just to clarify, when you're talking about the antibody test, which is a test for, obviously, for antibodies, but it's something that you can get after you've been infected and shows that you were infected in the past, but not necessarily actively infected. So I just wanted to clarify the distinction between that and the molecular test that you can get when you're feeling symptoms or if you just have been exposed and you want to find out if you're currently sick. So, yeah, I mean, I think that is definitely promising that she was able to, that she does have the antibodies still, you know, was it 8 months later now or something?
Yeah.
I know, you know, I live in Brooklyn as well, and it was horrific in March in terms of just the number of people who were getting sick and hospital, people being hospitalized and dying from the disease. And it is amazing how much the testing has improved since then, and I hope that that trend continues, but there's still a huge amount of the country that cannot get tests, and you know, just until we increase testing, we won't be able to know who's sick and who is able to transmit it to other people. So I think it's promising to know that antibodies can last a while, but I don't think people should necessarily be complacent that they couldn't get it again eventually. So we all just kind of need to keep being careful and, you know, wearing our masks and social distancing and all of that.
Sure, exactly. The Pfizer vaccine requires that it be kept at a very cold temperature. Can you talk about the distribution of Pfizer in these special crates and how long it has to be at the lower temperatures and some of the challenges with all of that?
Yeah, so that's a big issue with the Pfizer vaccine and also the Moderna vaccine. They both have to be kept at very cold temperatures. I believe the Pfizer vaccine is something like minus 70 degrees. Off the top of my head.
Yes.
But it's very cold, and you have to be able to keep it stable because the mRNA can degrade very easily. So this is not something that you're going to just be keeping, you know, in your fridge in a pharmacy. It's going to have to go through probably hospitals at first and maybe refrigerated facilities. There are other vaccines that are being developed that don't require that level of refrigeration. So those kinds of vaccines might be available to countries or settings where they don't have access to these really cold storage facilities. So hopefully those will come along as well. But in the meantime, you know, it's looking like the Pfizer vaccine and potentially the Moderna vaccine might be some, you know, the first to get approval. And those ones do require really cold temperatures.
Tanya, are all of these vaccines that are being developed around the world with this same RNA model?
Yeah, so not, that's a great question. The two that I just mentioned, Pfizer and Moderna, mm-hmm. both require mRNA, but there are many other vaccines that use other technologies. One example is the University of Oxford and AstraZeneca vaccine, which uses what's called an adenovirus. It's kind of cold virus that infects chimpanzees, I believe. And that is, they just use that virus to expose your body to proteins from the coronavirus. There are other vaccines that use like an inactivated version of the coronavirus that is not very potent. And that's how a lot of vaccines in the past historically have worked. Flu vaccines work similarly. So there's a lot of different approaches out there, but we'll just have to see, you know, which ones work best for this particular virus.
Knowing what you know about vaccines and these three different types, one where you administer a portion of the virus, one that where it's inactivated virus, and this new third, the mRNA, how do you feel if you were going to be vaccinating yourself, or how about your elderly parents? What do you trust the most? What do you feel the most promise about?
Well, Lynn, I think I have to say that I would feel comfortable with, as long as it has been approved and vetted by the FDA, I would take any of them. I would take the first one that is available because I have faith in the process of how these vaccines are being tested. And, you know, I think you can see right now the FDA is having this meeting to really go through the data, and they're not going to make any hasty decisions. So, you know, once it's approved and as soon as it's available, I will be lining up to get any vaccine.
What a challenge to supply chain, vaccinating a planet full of people. One of the big questions is, how do we keep accurate records of all of this? Somebody gets vaccinated, and they're going to need a booster at some period of time. Where do the manufacturers know where to ship to and to when, so that that person can get the booster? And you know, just keeping all these accurate records. What are your thoughts on that, Tanya?
That's a great question. I think that we're definitely going to have to make sure we have those records. I think we can probably rely on, in places like the U.S., there's a pretty good system for, you know, flu vaccination, for example, and just the medical record system here. So I think when people get vaccinated, you know, that information will be on file. And I want to just sort of take a minute to make people feel more comfortable that it's not like the government will be taking all of your data and, you know, using it against you somehow. This is going to be something that will help you have access to parts of society that have been shut down for so long. So things like taking a flight on an airplane, you might need to prove that you've been vaccinated, or going to a concert or things like that. I don't know for sure, but my guess is that I think having that proof of vaccination will be really important. So hopefully we can keep track of it.
Yeah, we had Jonathan Johnson on last week. He's the CEO of Overstock.com and also the president of Medici Ventures, which invest in blockchain companies. And we were asking him to help us understand what the future might be with blockchain technology. And he said that that we could be at a point where you carry around on your mobile phone all of your medical records, and they're your records, and nobody else has access to those. But if you're going to a concert, or if you're going to a sporting event, or if you want to get on an airplane, or if you want to go into a large public place, you could just open it up, and it would state that you have been vaccinated. You're not sharing that with anybody other than the fact that you have been vaccinated to allow entry into one of those events. But there's a way of being able to do it with blockchain technology that will protect your privacy so that everybody doesn't happen to know your medical history. I thought that was encouraging.
Yeah, that definitely is promising avenue. I think it is really important that we prioritize, you know, medical privacy. That's always been an important thing, you know, well before this pandemic, and we need to continue to prioritize that, because I hope that we can do this in a way that is, you know, not only allows people to safely, you know, enter society again, but also makes them feel reassured that their information is not going to be misused in any way.
Tanya, I'm wondering about the vaccines that have been administered in China and Russia already. I had read something about there's a vaccine that has not been approved in China, but it's being administered. What can you tell us about those vaccines?
Right. So those vaccines did not, you know, go through the sort of same level of widespread trial or sort of large trials that some of the vaccines like the Pfizer vaccine in the U.S. and in the U.K. And other countries have gone through. So I can't speak exactly to how much we know about their efficacy. I think there was a study about one of the Chinese vaccines done in, I want to say, Dubai or in the Middle East, and they said it was something like 85% effective, but I don't know if they had the same rigorous controlled, randomized controlled trial design that is like the gold standard for vaccine trials here in the U.S. and internationally. So I think, you know, it's really hard to evaluate. That's why we do all of these really rigorous trials, because we don't want to just be the first to approve a vaccine. We want to make sure that any vaccine we approve is safe, first of all, and effective as well. So I think it's important to go through those steps, and we'll have to see what happens with some of these other vaccines. But I personally feel more comfortable knowing that it's going through this more rigorous vetting process here in the U.S.
Right. One thing I haven't heard about is whether or not, you know, say you had COVID, you went through it in, you know, March, like John's daughter, you still have the antibodies, but Are those people, we know that the antibodies wane, and we, from what I've heard, even in less time than, say, 8 months. But I'm assuming that everyone is being encouraged, once the vaccine is approved, to get both doses of it. There's not, like, any sort of, if you have had antibodies coursing through your body, that you would have some sort of protection even though that wanes?
That's a great question. I mean, so first of all, I guess a certain amount of decline in antibodies is totally normal and expected. This happens with every virus that we know of, I think, at least, you know, it sort of levels off generally, but you continue to have a low level of antibodies, and then your body can kind of ramp those back up again if it encounters the virus. So I wouldn't be too concerned about some drop-off in antibodies. Obviously, if it's completely undetectable, that's not great. But yeah, it's a good question whether or not people who've had the virus, I suspect that they will eventually be encouraged to get vaccinated, but you know, perhaps there may be some prioritization of people that haven't had the virus. I don't know at this point. But yeah, I don't think we know at this point whether or not, you know, whether having the virus itself or the vaccine will provide longer protection. But it's a good question.
Tanya, I just have one other question, and that is that in the last couple of days, we've learned a couple things from the UK's start. You know, they've had the jump on this, and that is, if you are extremely allergic to all sorts of different things, then possibly you shouldn't have this vaccine unless you have an EpiPen with you, so that you can protect yourself. Have you heard anything about that at all?
Yeah, so I did see that the there were, I think, two people in the UK received the newly approved vaccine. And did have severe allergic reactions. But this is not a totally unexpected thing. It does happen with other vaccines. That's why, you know, you get that information every time you get your flu shot. There's a long list of things telling you if you have a history of severe allergies, you know, maybe you shouldn't get the vaccine. I think that investigators are looking into this now to see whether or not it would be safe for people who have those types of reactions to get the vaccine. But I wouldn't be overly concerned, because that does happen, and it's generally people that already have a history of severe allergy to vaccination. So we'll have to see, I think, what happens with that.
Tanya Lewis is the Associate Editor of Health and Medicine at Scientific American. She is joining us today, as she has over the last 8 months or so, from time to time, to give us updates on COVID. And Tanya, we'll be calling you again in January, I'm sure, to talk about how it's all going with the vaccine. So thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and it's always a pleasure.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Tanya.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening, and hey, tune in next week.